camera was going to have to say about all this. And then to my initially sense of kind of despair when he said, oh, maybe. And I recognise actually it's maybe as it's Halloween night and we're kind of encouraged to be facing some of these kind of ghosts, the spooks, and certainly one of mine is speaking in front of a lot of people. So it seems appropriate, maybe the thing to do is to bite the bullet and go for it. It's my first time really being in Spirit Rock, and I visited here about 6 years ago as an Anagarika, and it's the first time I've really been sitting in a retreat here. And I notice, you know, there's a kind of rumbling in the rock, rumbling in Spirit Rock, with a sense of, well, you know, this monastic retreat. We've had, you know, breakfast meetings, and one of the managers will come up and they're saying, oh, you know, there's kind of the rumbling at the kitchen, there's a change of routine and things need to be done, you know, a different routine. I'm sure there's a sort of rumbling of the stomach in the afternoon, people who are kind of used to. And, you know, I suppose perception of monastic retreat brings up in the mind. Oh, this is kind of, this is time to get serious, or is it sometimes perhaps, I mean, certainly for myself, when I first came in contact with a monastic form, one of the things I found a little distant from, certainly at first, was the sort of ceremonial part of practice, the kind of, yeah, working with ceremonies, and especially this practice of sharing of blessings. And sometimes it's, they call it the dedication of merit or something of the sort. And I've found in my own practice this is something that I've really warmed towards much more and more. And it's one thing, it's very interesting in the monastic life, being a Westerner in a tradition which is very much sort of steeped in Asian culture. In the monastery we'd often have people coming and requesting ceremonies, and they're people from a culture which is very steeped in Dhamma, very steeped in practice, and for them it's something that would always come very naturally. But certainly in my own case, to begin with, I used to think, maybe I can learn the chanting and I can be there, but it took me a while to warm up for it. One of the occasions that really started to change for me was when I was going on a, we do these walkabouts, we call it Tudong. I've done a few in England, where we just take our alms bowl and robes and go walking. And I was walking from Chithurst Monastery, where I lived, to my family home, my mother's place, about 120 miles or so. And I'm just going very, very simply, just with the clothes, pretty well I've got here now, in a bag and a bowl, and just leaving the monastery door and going for it. And so a lot of the time, you know, we were very much dependent on generosity of others entirely, and we never really knew whether we were going to eat or find any shelter. And I can remember one occasion where I found myself in a town and very tired and hungry. We'd had to walk about 15 miles that morning, and we had to get there fairly early in the morning to find enough time to make, you know, to move into an area where there may be some food shopping around. So I was standing there, and I was kind of exhausted, and in the way we practiced, we'd just stand there with our arms bowled. I can remember a little lady came past, she was one of the first people who spotted us, and rushed over and wanted to give us some coins and some money, which was nice, and I just sort of said, well, it's very, bless you, it's a lot of, you know, it's a nice offering, but we don't accept money. So she kind of, oh, surprised, and then she kind of waited along more, a bit more, and kind of questioned a bit more, and then explained that some food would be, you know, we would appreciate some food. And she became very excited because she thought, oh, these are real monks. and she would actually, she stood in the street for a little while, and she'd be pointing to us and saying, look, real monks, they want food. They want, no. Which is wonderful, wonderful blessing for us, because we train ourselves not to ask. So she was doing the whole thing. It's kind of like our, doing a promotion for us, so it's wonderful to have her there. And she went off, and she was I would say probably in her 80s, and she had a little trundle, one of these little baskets with wheels on. She raced off and got loaded herself with lots of very carefully thought out things. A hot day, so she got drinks, and you know, really put some effort into it. Gave us all these things. In the meantime, she made contact with other people who also said, "Oh, well, I'm going to the shops. I'll be back." So we found ourselves kind of in a situation of receiving lots and lots of far too much. So we found, you know, we were kind of put in a position where I had to stay there for a while and just take all this. I was just kind of taking it all up. It was a wonderful thing. And the lady was standing in front of me. And she kept holding my arm and saying, "Oh, you know, real monks." She's very excited, and she said, "You know," and she was quite emotional, and she was saying, "You know, I really don't know. I wonder whether you could help me, or whether you could." No, that's right. She asked me if I could pray for her, and I said, "Oh, yeah. What do you want? We'd certainly do that." And she said, "Well, just about a few months ago, I lost my husband." And she said they'd been married for 50 years. And she was very kind of emotional about describing it. And she said, "You know, I'm not sure that I'm going crazy. You know, I sit in the sofa where we used to sit, and I put his pullover next to me on the sofa, and I put the arm of this sweater around, you know, kind of." And you think, oh, you know, it's kind of really touching kind of things. And she said, "You know, I'd like to send some prayers for him, you know, do something." This is an extraordinary lady. And so I started to try and explain. I said that we would do some chanting. Once we'd collected our food, we'd go back out of the village and we'd do some chanting, and we'd dedicate this for the well-being of her husband. And then I thought, well, I'll try and explain a little bit more about what it means. And I had to do it fairly briefly, but the theory being really is that in performing a kind of act of generosity, kindness, it's very, very difficult to kind of making contact, you know, in a direct way with somebody, a departed loved one or relative. But the story or the theory behind it is that there are beings in this world, the heavenly realms, the deva realms, who really, really enjoy and appreciate and kind of focus very much on acts of kindness and generosity. They really get a hit off it and enjoy it. They think, wow, this is wonderful. And they kind of, it's something that they will focus upon. And if in an act of kind of then dedicating that to somebody who's passed away, it's like they become a messenger, because these beings certainly will know where this other, where the loved one had gone, you know, if their rebirth or where they were, and they would be able to then, you know, act like protectors or send some good things on. So it was kind of, that was the theory. And I said, you know, in doing what you've done, it's a beauty, you know, explaining this is something that's obviously come very naturally from her. And you know, we would certainly dedicate these offerings to our husband. And she just kind of she started weeping. She was very moved, and she said, you know, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. And she moved away from this. And I could see she just sat. She just sat on a little wall opposite for quite a while. And she was kind of very tearful, but it was tears of joy. You know, there wasn't grief there. It was kind of when you think, oh. And I left with tears as well. And I realised actually, yeah, you know, there's a real kind of a relevance to practicing with this kind of ritual way actually. And you know, part of the chanting when we come down collecting the alms food from Ajahn Amaro, he'll often start with like a little solo, and I hope I can get it right, but more or less the what it's saying is like, just as, you know, during this ceremony, when we're chanting these things, quite often people from Thailand and Buddhist cultures, they like to do what's called a water pouring ceremony, where you have a little vessel, empty vessel, and then it's standing inside a larger one, and they pour water into the small one and it overflows. And it's kind of, the chant says something like, you know, just as all the water flows into the rivers and then overflows into the sea, in the same way that, you know, in making an offering to something, you know, is worthy, making such a gesture of generosity to a group of monastics or people who are practicing towards realizing truth. This is something of extraordinary meritorious act, and in doing that, it would overflow rather than just staying contained within that community. The blessings can overflow. So it's and I found, you know, after having witnessed this many times in my life as a monk, I see more and more the value of it. But it's still what I think became more apparent in my own practice is when I started looking at for furthering that really, and seeing that it's not just one idea. You know, you may say, "Oh yeah, you know, devas, heavenly beings, are the world's," yeah, maybe not. You know, it's like there's a maybe you don't. You know, that's something that's very difficult to tap into. But actually, I've also discovered in practice, very much in dealing with grief, these things, a dedication of blessings is something I've personally found very, very useful. It's a very healing practice. And it was interesting when I started looking at all the messages appearing on the shrine. It really tripped in a few things for me. I was recollecting some of the... I think most of us have been touched and will either have or certainly will experience grief at the loss of a loved one. And I know in my own life I had, not long before I came to live in the monastery, to leave the home life. My father took his life, which was something he did it like a couple of days, a few days after I was explaining to him that I really, I was kind of somewhat disillusioned with what was going on. I was looking at moving to the monastery. And it was a time when, for in his life, he was somebody who used to get, he suffered a great deal from depression. And although, that was kind of very, very difficult for us, and over the years it brought us very, very close. And so, he would sort of often kind of lean on me a lot and would very much be looking at me for help and support when he was really low. So naturally, I was kind of, the whole experience was something of a horrendous shock, there was a period in my life, where I was just kind of very numbed by the whole thing. And there was a long, long period where I had a very strong image in my mind of my father's corpse, and it was very, a very violent death. I kind of had a very strong image in my mind of a very distorted and stressed image, very, very violent image. So it was, for a long time, it was something which it was kind of very much the central focus in my meditation practice. And there was a kind of recognition that there was that sort of feeling of helplessness, not really knowing, quite understanding how we can, what I can do, how I could, a sense that I'd like to, there's an enormous sense of loss, and also just the fact that I could no longer communicate, and I could no longer, this kind of a sense of woundedness and inability to understand how to resolve that. And then, but as time went on, I discovered that once I'd moved into Sangha life, and there was this sort of, I realized that there was kind of a golden opportunity to start really looking very closely at healing some of these things. So much of my, my ordination ceremony was very consciously dedicated, this, what I was doing for the well-being of my father. And many acts of just generosity, kindness, I would make kind of, anything that I felt was really, I had it uplifting, I would think of Don. It's like, yeah, this was. And as I kept working with this, and it was, things started to change. It was kind of quite beautiful, actually, because what was happening in my dreams and my memories of him, instead of a kind of a very frightened, tortured being that would appear in my mind, slowly they were being transplanted by a sense of kind of joy and sharing and happiness and contentment. It was just like very clearly changing that kind of impression in the mind. So it does. Even in if we consider the way the theoretical side of devas, the feeling of how is it we can resolve some of the emptiness in our lives, that resolve the woundedness, resolve that sense of loss, then this is something I find an extraordinarily skillful means. One of the strongest What's the word? That's one of the most powerful of the what we call Brahma Vihara, of these kind of boundless realms, boundless experiences. Is one of the I've practiced with a lot in this area has been mudita. Mudita is sometimes, you know, I've seen it, it's translated as joy or gladness, but it seems kind of a hollow experience. I often see it, feel it very much more as, it's like the opposite of envy. It's kind of a real genuine resonance, a kind of joy and recognition of blessing of others' good fortune. It's like that sort of sense of seeing, you know, when somebody else wins the prize and resonating with their joy, you know, it's a kind of, it's a sense, it's a very, and this is something that you know, I find very, very good to ponder on. I know certainly in the monastery there's sometimes we find these occasions where mind can get kind of, you know, I can feel something of an uphill experience, and sometimes I find, you know, it kind of can get, there's a dryness, or I need to kind of find something to dig myself out of an emotional hole. And one of the things I often like to do is just little anonymous acts of generosity or kindness. You know, so I would wash somebody's socks for them, or, you know, and put them out, and so they wouldn't know it was me. Or I'd tidy something up, and then, but I'd be around when they spotted it. And it's delightful. It's really worth it. It's one of these things, and you recognise that it's like this is really what, you know, sharing of good of blessings is about. And so it's, I mean, in these occasions, it's very, and what I find very fruitful just to contemplate is we're starting to practice in a way of actually looking for opportunities for sharing of blessings, you know, to actually creating blessings in order to share them. Looking for opportunities to brighten the heart and mind. And a lot of the time, I'm sure very aware, in a sort of retreat mode, it can be, mind can get kind of quite cramped. Issues can arise, emotions and feelings can come up, and the whole thing becomes kind of walking around with this lump. Oh. That one again, you know, it's a kind of, it's a hard, or it's difficult to move the mind from a particular fixation or emotion. And certainly, you know, the practice of what we're doing here, we're just recollecting. I could really sense the kind of the power. There's a very, very strong. Strong kind of heartfelt and emotional charge coming in here with all these things. You know, you recognize it's something that we're all very familiar with. And it's something that we're all, you know, we are practicing with. And often it's very easy in grief, you know, to just, there's a sense of kind of reveling in it, or confusion, or a sense of loss. But it's, I think, with, you know, when we're reflecting very skillfully, it can actually, we can transform these things into a blessing. in going, I'm just letting the mind wander on into something kind of connected. I was thinking of this, facing the ghost. So, I remember there's a lovely story of somebody telling me a story of a Hungarian, I think, folk tale about a little town, a little village, which was haunted by a ghost, or like a demon. And there was only one path. They were surrounded by mountains. There's one road out, and this thing was there, looming. And nobody was going out anywhere. They weren't going to the neighbouring town. This thing was there, and there was kind of very few people would venture out. One or two did, and came scuttling back again. And it was big, and it was ugly, and it was definitely to be avoided. Until there was a young child, kind of a young kid. He thought, "Oh, I know what this was." So he decided to go and check it out. And sure enough, he went down this road, and there it was, this enormous fire-breathing monster standing in the middle of the road. And he thought, "Wow, yeah, that's incredible." And what he did, rather than just run off, he just took like a step forward, just a small step. And it had this impression it got a little bit smaller. Oh, that's interesting. So he took another step, you know. This continued happening until he got right up to it, and it was just, you know, the size of a pepper pot on the rock. And he looked at this thing and he said, "Well, you know, so, what are you? Who are you?" And this little thing says, "Fear. Fear." You know, it's something that was very interesting just now. I mean, I started off this thing with a dry throat, and then gradually as I starts to loosen up. I was thinking that, you know, Ajahn Amaro would be talking for an hour, and this is I said all the best bits. Interesting. So I think in closing I would encourage that to explore this practice of sharing blessings. Don't take my word for it. Don't take, you know, check it out for yourself. I found it very rewarding, very helpful. And it starts to turn the tide. It heals. And it tends to move the mind very much more into more of an open and expansive, receptive space. Anyone?
Annamaya Novadagata Sadhu Parangadhamase Sadhu 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 Anmodam. So just to continue the theme for the evening, we'll close with the sharing of blessings. Maybe we'll do the Pali version, now that you're becoming extraordinarily adept in Pali pronunciation. That's page 21. Need a bit more light, I think. Yeah. There's some discussion, I think.
Do you want to mention half an hour after the chanting that we're going to step to midnight?
You can.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Chant first. Yeah, we'll chant first. And, okay.
Annamaya no disanaditana gatayo manamase
Mina punya kamena
Ubhajaya gunutara Acharyo pakara chamata Pita chanyataka Suryo chandimara Gunavanda Narabija Brahmamara Chahinda Chalokapala Chadevata Yamomita Manusa Chamaja Tawerika Pichasabe Sada Suki Honda Bunyani Pakatani Me Sukan Jati Videndu Ki Pangba Peta Womata Imina Punya Kamena Imina Udi Sena Chaki Paham Sulabe Chevata Nupadana Chenanam Ye Sandhani Hina Dhamma Yavani Manato mamanasandu savada yeva yata jato pave pave uchuchitam satipanya saleko viriya minamara labanduno kasankatuncha virie sume bhunadi pavaronato Tamo nato varutamo nato Pacheka buddho ca sangho Nato taro mamangteso Tamanu bhave namaro Kasang labandu
As a way to extend the theme into the evening, Venerable Achalo and myself have decided to stay up till the witching hour and create some blessings and share the blessings. And so if anyone would like to do that, then most welcome to join us. I'm staying out to meditate, sitting and walking till midnight.
The Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. The teaching, so completely explained by him, I bow to the Dhamma. The Blessed One's disciples, who have practiced well, I bow to the Sangha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
I realize that many people have traveled long distances today and or have been busy winding everything up in their lives and have been doing a lot to get everything packed away in order to do this retreat, and so people are probably a little weary this evening, including myself. A few long days and short nights running up to this retreat. So I'll endeavor to be succinct. Not always the easiest thing for me. But I just want to state this intention at the beginning. But I thought that it would be useful to say a few things as this retreat begins. Now this... this retreat is put forth as a monastic retreat, and in the various notices speaking about this time, we outlined it as trying to make it as if it were, say, 10 days in the monastery. And obviously there's some differences, but I thought I might talk a little bit about that as a principle, and why we might do that, and what that consists of, or the different elements that are part of that. There are many different elements to living in a monastery, in a monastic style of practice, not just for the monastics, but also for the lay community who either live at the monastery or come and visit and participate in the life. So along with the formal times of meditation practice, sitting or walking meditation, there's a lot of other dimensions to the way of life, some of which are contained also within other retreat situations, some of which are a bit more unique. So one of these is say we have the devotional, ceremonial side is much more visible, much more exercised. So just as we have a shrine with candles and incense, and we have the practice of bowing, and during the course of the week we can have little bowing workshops and talk about that a little bit, and chanting, of course, which every morning, every evening, there'll be periods of traditional devotional chanting in English and Pali, and people are welcome, invited to join in with that. So this whole ceremonial element, ritual element, is much more present in the monastic, traditional way of following the Buddhist path. It's not the kind of essential or central feature, but it's a quality, a presence within our days. It brackets, it's like the parentheses of the day, of the morning and evening meditation and chanting. And also like an ongoing presence during the day. Part of our practice is whenever we enter a room where there's a shrine, where we're going to stop and spend even a few minutes. Like when you come into a room like here, then we bow three times when we arrive, and then bow three times before we leave. You come even into your own room, your own cabin, your kuti, then you bow three times to the shrine when you come in, you bow three times before you leave. So there's like an ongoing presence of that ritual, that use of that form throughout the course of a day, so that it creates an environment of recollection. and of respect, of honoring something which is higher than me. Something in this world which is a little bit more noble than my ego and my preferences and my physical, emotional concerns. Bowing to wisdom, to truth, to virtue, to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So that's one element. A monastery, just like a retreat, has a routine, has a certain sets of rules and precepts, do's and don'ts, and the pattern of a day's activities. There's the time for formal meditation, the time for working, physical engagement in helping tasks around the place. So this is very similar. You know, all of you signed up for your different yogi jobs, and vegetable chopping or bathroom cleaning or whatever it might be. So it's just exactly the same in the monastery. One of the elements that is maybe also slightly different is that you have the presence of us monastics here. I remember years ago when Ajahn Sumedho, our teacher in England, would come and teach here in the States, either on the East Coast or here in California. Jack Kornfield would invite him to come and teach out here through the 80s and early 90s. And he would comment that in some ways the robe seemed to be invisible to people. That it was like he was just another meditation teacher who happened to be, you know, costume freak. He just liked walking around in a brown sheet, but that was just his thing. You know, this is Berkeley, this is the way people are. He just kind of, he's a brown sheet kind of guy, and that's all, you know. No big deal. And then being out of the context, being on his own and just being a brilliant speaker, then people would listen to his words, be awed, and then the fact that he happened to live as a monk, and also the fact that he was living in a retreat situation, everyone else was being very restrained and nun-like or monk-like in their conduct, you know, didn't really emphasize what that was coming from or his the origins of his costumery. So just last weekend, several of us, Sister Jitindriya and Don Acholo, myself, some of the other members of the community were up at a conference for monastics in Shasta Abbey, up at Mount Shasta, a group of about 25 of us, different Buddhist traditions, people living a celibate monastic life, gathered, Chinese tradition, Tibetan, Vietnamese, Theravada. The theme of the conference was the four heavenly messengers. And probably many of you are familiar with the life story of the Buddha and the mythology of the four, what are called the four signs, that when he was a bodhisattva, as a prince, he had lived a very protected life. As the myth goes, that his father was so worried that he was going to be drawn towards religion that he contrived to make his son grow up without ever seeing sickness, aging, or death, so that he wouldn't ask the religious questions. And as the story goes, of course, that failed, and he snuck out and on the streets of Kapilavatthu, on different occasions, met with the sight of an ailing person, someone who's very sick, someone who was aged, bent over, and haggard, stooped and wrinkled with age. And then someone who was dead, a corpse being carried to his funeral, and asking his charioteer, Channa, what's happened to these people? You know, what's become of them? Why are they like that? And Channa said, oh, that's a sick person, or that's an old person, or that's a dead person. And then the bodhisattva asked, well, is this something, you know, very unusual or weird? What a terrible thing to happen. And Channa says, oh, this happens to everyone. This is not abnormal. This is not some kind of weird aberration. This is the norm. And then the shock that the bodhisattva received on hearing that. Now, oftentimes the fourth of the heavenly messengers gets missed, And at this conference, we emphasized that along with aging, sickness, and death, as the heavenly messengers, the signals that cause us to wake up and want to do something about our life. The fourth heavenly messenger is that of the religious seeker. And this was like the catalyst that had the effect of impelling the bodhisattva from his life, a materialistic life of comfort, and then a materialistic life that had gone sour, having met with the first three messengers. Like, this is a bad deal. This is going to happen to me. I'm going to get all haggard and stooped and incontinent, and I'm going to die. That then the fourth messenger was the messenger of hope, or the resolution to those puzzles. And that was the sight of a religious seeker, a wanderer. And when he asked his charioteer, "Well, what's that guy doing? This one with the ragged robes and the walking staff, and his hair in a knot on the top of his head. Why is he dressed like that? What is he doing?" And Chana said, "Oh, he's seeking the deathless. He is one who has committed his life to the spiritual path." He says, "Deathless? What's that?" He says, "Oh, this is what people who practice religion are aimed at, is transcending the world of aging, sickness, and death." "Oh, there's a way out. That's a way." And of course, being built upon a mountain of paramita, of accumulated spiritual virtues, then that sight and that little piece of knowledge, information, was enough to catalyze this massive reaction within his being and cause him to leave the palace and to seek the way. And then, of course, 6 years later, finding the truth of the Dhamma and realizing the middle way. So one of the things that I found, certainly when I stumbled into a monastery in Thailand, was that over 20 years ago, was that a major effect on me was the presence of the monastic community, just being around the robes and the a group of people committed to a spiritual lifestyle. Now, I'm not trying to inflate us as the sort of great spiritual beings. I mean, we might stand up here and we've got the spotlights on us, and we all look sort of very spiffy. But, we have hemorrhoids and bad breath, just like you guys, along with, pardon my over-familiarity, but... So it's not as though you're trying to pretend that by putting on robes and shaving your head that some kind of miraculous transformation instantly takes place. But it's the gesture of renunciation and the form of a monastic lifestyle is like a reminder. And there's a very wonderful, slightly academic book by a fellow called Raimondo Panikkar called Blessed Simplicity, where he points out, or makes a case for, he's a Christian theologian who's also a Hindu Buddhist cross, half Indian, half Spanish, so sort of half yogi, half Jesuit kind of character. But he makes this very beautiful case of how the monastic form represents an intrinsic quality in the hearts of every human being. And that this is, in a way, trying to embody in a physical plane or in physical manifestation certain qualities of our own being, the deepest qualities of our being. That there is that in us which is, completely harmless, that in all of us which is completely incapable, which loves truth, which recoils from untruth or... is unable to be violent, is unable to be selfish. That quality of our own nature, which needs absolutely nothing, which is complete unto itself, and doesn't need to get rid of anything either. It's a quality of, as T.S. Eliot put it, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. But there's a this quality of our own being. You can call it our own heart or the unconditioned mind, which is completely, free of concerns of sexuality or gender. It's not, has no gender or age or size or shape or color. That those qualities have just don't pertain in that domain of our own being, of our heart. That it is a quality that loves to know, that loves to that loves wakefulness, that is alert, clear. So that the form that a Buddhist monastic, a nun or a monk assumes, and the rules that we take on, are like a formalization of that quality of our own spirit, our own nature as human beings. So it's like establishing that as a structure of behaviors on an external level in order to help us to resonate and to realize more deeply, more easily, more fully that quality which is within all of us. So that the presence of monastics, I found when I first arrived in the monastery in Thailand and had no intention of you know, being a monk ever, you know. I did not like rules and restrictions and having to behave in any other way than followed my own preferences. But I found myself really struck by the power of that presence and the kind of example and guide that it gave, not in a kind of stiff or pompous or self-righteous way, but just a kind of resonance of a beauty to aspire to live up to gravitate towards. So this is how monasteries work in a Theravadan world. There's always a group of monastics that live in the monastery, but a far greater group, maybe 50, 100 times as large, are a lay community who gathers around, who likes to draw near, who participates in the environment and contributes to sustaining the environment that and the monastics, the people who live within the monastery, and they're also one of their main concerns is sustaining and upholding that environment that that encourages all of us to realize more directly and deeply those qualities of the unconditioned, of the pure, of the liberated, of the utterly awake and free aspects of our own nature, which is what draws us, which is what brings us to spend a valuable holiday time from work and to spend it in a situation such as this. That's the innate magnetism, the kind of secret gravitation that draws all things to truth as to its center. So that in a retreat like this, then hopefully, then the one of the elements is that then those of us who are sort of taken formal commitment as monks or nuns, that we can act as that fourth messenger, and to it's difficult to you may talk about this without saying you've got to look up to us as being these kind of fantastic wonderful things, but just sort of talking about the archetype I think is helpful, so that having that around is helping to just sort of create a resonance within the heart. When the monks were first invited to England to start up a monastery there, Ajahn Chah came with them. This was 1977, more than 20 years ago. When he was about to leave them and was sort of giving them final instructions before he headed off back to Thailand and left them sort of marooned in this little house in London, he said to them, if you want to change the robes and that to fit in with the climate, you can do that. And if you need to change the chanting and any of the kind of ceremonies and things to fit in with local customs, you can do that, that's fine. However you want to change it, that's okay. But one thing that you have to do every day is to go out on alms round. And they thought, what? And he really laid it on thick, and they thought, the old man's losing it. What? why arms around? I mean, like, who in London is going to put any food in our bowls? You know? It's like, he's crazy. What's up? And Ajahn Chah was known as being an extremely level-headed, practical person. But he got very, very strong on this point. And he said, well, two things. One, if you stay together in this little house, you know, cooped up and never going anywhere, you're going to be at each other's throats before too long. You'll all go crazy. But more important was that your job is to be the heavenly messenger. You fly the Buddha's flag, the robe, to let people see that fourth messenger. So that even if they don't know what you are, they don't put any food in your bowl, they don't have any clue about Buddhism, just the sight of a person who is making a gesture of commitment towards realization of truth, and that the form of the renunciant has an archetypal effect. And that's your gift. That's a part of your life, your job, to do that. So they heard it, and since that time we've sustained that, and the effects have been remarkable. And you know, during the next week we'll talk a bit more about that. But it is it's proved to have been a great gift. In fact, the way we established the first forest monastery in England was because of the monks going out on alms round. They were spotted walking across Hampstead Heath by this guy who they were a bunch of monks living in London looking for a forest, and he was the guy who owned a forest looking for some forest wardens to come and take care of it. So that's the short version of the story. So another of the aspects of a monastic form and part of our training is the quality of contentment. So something of this I talked about in the letter that went out to everyone, that there's a strong emphasis that when we take our ordination, then you make a deal with the preceptor. And a couple of deals that you make with the preceptor. One of them is that you will be his burden if he... you take on the burden of helping to look after the preceptor, but the preceptor takes on the role of teaching you. So you say, I will be the burden of the elder, and the elder's burden will be mine. So that's one deal we make. Another of the deals that we make is that from this day forth, I undertake to live on whatever robes, whatever kind of thrown away cloth, scraps of discarded cloth I can find or come to me. That's what I'll wear as clothing. I'm content with that. I make myself content with any food that lands in my bowl, whatever I'm offered as food. I make myself content with that. Whatever arrives, that's okay. If nothing arrives, that's okay. So alms food as a support. Whatever shelter, just living at the root of a tree, is fine. Yeah, you establish that from this day on. I take as my standard living at the root of a tree. If something better comes along, if someone provides me with a beautiful house or a lovely kind of cabin with underfloor heating and fitted bathroom and etc., then that's fine. Staying in a posh hotel, that's fine. But the standard that you take on, the deal that you make, is okay. From now on, even just living at the root of a tree is fine. And even if you, in your heart you don't feel it's fine, you still establish the thought. Like, you say, well, that's something I have to aspire to, even if my wishes of the moment say, I don't want this, I want something nicer. But that's the deal that you strike, is that I have no right to ask for more than this. This is my intent, is to be okay, to be pleased with just that lowest standard. And then the most basic natural medicines, whatever kind of natural medicines are available, to be content with that. So you establish like the lowest possible standard of living from the very beginning. And then whatever comes after that, whatever, which is usually extremely good. I mean, we get offered very beautiful food almost all the time. And the shelters and clothing, very fine, comfortable things that arrive, and a great array of medicines and medical insurance and so forth. But what happens when you establish the lowest standard of living as your basis is that everything else is gravy. You know, it's like, oh great, look at this, you know. A roof that doesn't leak, wonderful. You know, wow, hot water in the tap, amazing. A sink in my room, incredible. Electric lights, wow. Well, those of you who don't live in sort of candle-lit, unplumbed cabins, it probably is not very meaningful to you, but, you know, just coming here to Spirit Rock, it's like, wow, I don't have to find my matches in the morning, you know, and I don't have to walk half a mile to get to a sink, you know. So that one then becomes very easy. There's a kind of easiness that we find within our heart, a spaciousness. We're kind of gravitating away from the fussiness and neediness and narrowness that is so painful, that that can cramp so much of our life and our heart so easily. So that within this retreat, then this is part of the style or the teaching, is that, you know, this quality of contentment with the room that you got, contentment with the food that's offered, contentment with the weather, contentment with the teachings, contentment with our own mind, you know, that or the health of our body. You know, sometimes, you know, if you've ever been on a retreat and you come down with a cold on the first day, and you think, oh no, I can't believe it. No, this is not acceptable. Does your nose listen as it runs? No, it doesn't pay the slightest bit of attention. It just runs merrily along. So this quality of contentment is a really major spiritual tool. It's called santusati. Santusati in Pali. That consciously cultivating that sense of, well, it's... that it might not be perfect, but it's good enough. And this was Ajahn Chah's way of when people would greet him and they'd say, how are you? You know, in Thai it would be sabai dimai, you know, are you well? And he'd say, di po di, good enough, good. He wouldn't say, oh yeah, I'm fine, or sabai di. He wouldn't say, I'm fine, he'd say, I'm good enough. And so some people would be offended by that. Like, huh. But actually it was a very skillful response. Like, if we're always expecting life to be perfect or just how we like it, then where are we? We're always just a couple of notches down in the disappointment category. Or even when if it does come out good, then it's like, oh, great, now I've got it. But if we expect life to be good enough, it's good enough. Yeah, this room's good enough. The weather's good enough. My mind's good enough. My body's good enough. Then there's a... even though that might sound like we're just being wishy-washy, if we reflect on it and really work things in that way with skill and wisdom, you realize, again, there's a spaciousness that our life takes on. That there's a kind of ease of heart that we discover when we're not always fretting, trying to make it better or keep hold of the good, where we are finding that quality of adaptation. As Suzuki Roshi summarized it one time by saying, Buddhism is the difference between, it's the transformation of where we go from getting what we like to liking what we get. So it's like a training in learning to like what we get, to appreciate whatever it is that's arrived. So at the beginning of a retreat, I always like to emphasize that the best attitude to adopt as a retreat begins is that a readiness to learn from whatever arrives. Just as, you know, our training as monastics is to receive alms food appreciatively. Whatever arrives in our bowl, we accept with appreciation. We don't have to eat everything that arrives, but we accept it all with appreciation. So similarly, whatever arrives in the bowl of your consciousness, to receive it graciously. Oh, how wonderful. I eat. Today I have some mind states. How wonderful. Then we start to negotiate with, like, whoa, what's that one? Oh, not that again. 5 days in a row. So there's this quality of readiness to work with whatever arises, and a readiness to learn from whatever arises, rather than having a set plan of how we want it to be. I mean, the plans arise, the set plans manifest, take shape whether we like them to or not. But just really consciously and clearly intending, like whatever arises, whether it's beautiful or ugly, internal or external, physical or mental, whatever it is, what can I learn from this? What's this teaching me? If we put that right in the front line, then nothing can go wrong. This will be a perfect retreat, guaranteed perfect retreat. Can't go wrong. Even if it's some crisis at home and you get these telephone calls and you're torn about whether you should leave or go, or some physical issue, all kinds of things. Some kind of dreadful memory that comes up and plagues you. Ajahn Sumedho was here in April of last year. He told this story about this obsessive thought that landed in his mind one day, which was arrived out of nowhere, which was, Gwendolyn, what are you to me? He thought, Gwendolyn? Who the heck's Gwendolyn? And he kind of mentioned this a couple of times, and it became such a hit with the people, everyone on the retreat. Probably many of you are here, but Gwendolyn now has a substantial existence in the universe, just through the number of people who've heard the story. As also, this is one of the other aspects of this retreat, is this is a very special kind of historical occasion, since this is the first long retreat that Spirit Rock has held, just done on Dana. As I'm sure everyone here is well aware, just completely on free will offerings. So this is a different trend. This is a different approach. Our daylongs have always been done that way, and we've here. But this is the first long residential retreat to be done in this way. And so this will be the last of the things that I thought I'd mention would be about this. And I remember when I arrived in the monastery in Thailand, I was not only just being struck by the lifestyle of the monastics and the relationship between the village and the monastery and the great beauty of that. One thing that was really staggering to me was that these guys didn't want anything from me. It's like, I remember, I was very suspicious of religions altogether, and particularly sort of uniform-wearing, rule-keeping religions. And my experience before had always been you had to pay up your money and then you went along to the weekend workshop or whatever. And then I remember coming to the monastery and then realizing and being told that there's no charge for staying there, absolutely none. And it wasn't like, there's no charge and, here's the donation bowl. nice, gigantic bucket, right by the door. It was clear that it was utterly insignificant to the monks there. It was of no consequence at all. They didn't want anything from me. And I'd never met this before in my life. That there was no suggestion that I kind of give any money. I mean, my entire fiscal worth was about $25 at that point. So they couldn't have got much anyway. But it was a very, very striking thing that if I wanted to be at the monastery, I was welcome to stay for a day or a week or a month or a lifetime. But if I wanted to stay, I couldn't just be there as an observer. It was, if you're here, you are part of the community. You can't just visit. You are the community. And so it struck me as being rather like when the Steppenwolf arrives at the door of the Magic Theater and reads the sign that says, "Price of admission, your mind." So it's very much like that. It's like, we don't want any money, but if you're here, you've got to give your heart to being here. And if you want to stay, you can stay. If you want to go, you can go. And also that there was also no feeling that we're looking for converts or we're the greatest thing in the world. And if you had half a head full of sense, you'd realize that and join us. I was like, no, we like to do this. This is what we do. If you want to join in, you can. If you don't want to join in, that's fine. Go your own way. It's up to you. Which again, it was an attitude I'd never ever met before. And so in a similar way, this the process of dana, the process of just living on free will, generosity between beings, is again a system which opens things up. I mean, what the effect that had on me at that time was like, I am now entering a different country. I've never been anywhere where people function like this. I don't know this place. This is different. And but an immense attraction. It's like, wow, this is amazing. How can they function like this? How does it work? And in a way, going back to the subject of contentment, it works because they were prepared to go without. That's the kind of core of the system, is that, yeah, well, if things come in to support us, if the food arrives, we eat. If there's no food arrives, then we don't eat. Fine. If that happens for too many days, then we'll just go somewhere else. And so that that kind of readiness to trust and to, in a way, ride on the benevolence of the universe, to trust that if one is living in a virtuous way, if one is doing something that is of value, then the universe responds. Similarly, when Ajahn Sumedho was talking with Ajahn Chah years and years ago, and Ajahn Chah said, "Do you ever think you're going to go back to America, Sumedho?" He said, "America? How could I live as a monk in America? You know, there wouldn't be anyone to offer alms food." And Ajahn Chah responded by saying, "Are there no kind people in America?" That was the point when Ajahn Sumedho realized he was going to be coming back. You know, up until then, he just assumed, well, no, I mean, he couldn't live as a monk outside of Thailand or the East.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.